Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen, and on today's episode, we are going to have part one of another interview with Jerry Branum. We are still doing our review, end-of-the-year review that we do at the end of every year, and I know we're in February now, but it takes a while to get through it, and we are now up to 1991, so we're going 30 years back at the end of 2021, and Jerry and I are going to talk about the year 1991, which includes many very significant contests in bodybuilding history. 1991 was the last year that Lee Haney won the Mr. Olympia. It was his eighth Mr. Olympia win. It took place in Orlando, Florida, and it was one of the most popular and most memorable Mr. Olympias to date. Lee beat out Dorian Yates, who was competing in his first Mr. Olympia, and Dorian took second in that contest. And there was also, Lee Labrada and Sean Ray and Vince Taylor, who took third place. So it was a great show. So we're going to talk about that. Actually, we'll probably talk about that next week in part two. And some of the other events we're going to talk about was the 1991 Ironman Invitational, which was the second time they held that contest. And that was won by J.J. Marsh. We're also going to talk about the 1991 Arnold Classic, which that was the third Arnold Classic, and Sean Ray was the winner of that. Sean won the contest also the year before, 1990, but that was the year they did drug testing, and then Sean failed the drug test and had to give back the title and the trophy. So he came back in 1991 and got revenge. We're going to talk about the 1991 Night of the Champions, which Dorian Yates won. And we're also going to talk about the 1991 NPC USA, won by Mike Matarazzo, and the NPC Nationals, which was won by Kevin Lavrone in an all-star lineup. So a lot of great shows to talk about in 1991. And so me and Jerry are going to do a two-part interview. This will be part one. At the beginning of the interview today, Jerry and I talk a little bit about the passing of two bodybuilders who just passed away the last couple of days. Tom Prince, who was a top, he won the 1997 NPC Nationals overall, and then he went on to be a professional bodybuilder for a few years. Tom was a huge guy, had a lot of potential. People thought he was going to go really far, and then he ended up having kidney failure and had to drop out of the sport, and I believe he got a kidney transplant. So me and Jerry are going to talk about that. Tom just recently died a couple of days ago of cancer at the age of 52, so another tragedy in the world of bodybuilding, another guy going way too soon, only 52 years old. We're also going to talk about the life of Marvin Etter. Marvin was an old school bodybuilder who competed around the time of Reg Park, and he was known as one of the strongest bodybuilders ever. So Marvin was 90 years old. He turned 90 last October. He's from Brooklyn, New York, and he just passed away a couple of days ago. So at the end of our podcast, after we talk to Jerry, I'm going to read an excerpt from a book, and it's called Legends of the Iron Game. I don't know if you guys have ever seen this series of books. It was written by Bill Pearl, and it's three volumes. If you ever get a chance to buy this, I really suggest you get, if you can get your hands on it, really purchase it. It's a great series of books about all the significant historical figures in the world of bodybuilding, going all the way back to the 1800s. And all the way up until mostly the present day, the golden age, I would say. So this was in volume two, and they have a whole chapter in here about Marvin Etter. And I talk about it with Jerry on the interview, but I'm going to read the whole chapter at the end of our interview today after we get done talking to Jerry for part one. All right. So I missed the show last week. I was getting over whatever I had. I think I had COVID, to be honest with you, because I talked to a couple of people who had COVID, and it sounded like all the symptoms of that Omicron virus that was going around. I had sore throat, headaches, body aches, And I just wasn't better last weekend when I was supposed to interview Jerry. So we had to delay it 1 week. So sorry about that, guys. But I'm back. A little bit of a head cold, but mostly back to training. I started training last week. So I don't want to miss too much training. And what else? We got some emails. So I want to read these emails from last week. If you guys want to email me out there, you can do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. This first email says, "Hey, John, I was curious about purchasing one of your books that you've written. I find your bodybuilding journey quite inspiring, and I would appreciate it if you could recommend a particular book that details your personal bodybuilding journey or life story. Much appreciated and regards, Peter Schuler from Australia. P.S. If you're ever down here in Australia for a seminar, I'd be keen to hear about that too." Well, I have not written an autobiography, Peter, but I did write a book called Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder. And in that book, I detail all the natural bodybuilding competitions I went in from 1991, which was my first natural bodybuilding show, to 1998 when I won the Natural Olympia. And I talk a little bit about, a lot about the preparation I did for each one of those shows as far as the training and nutrition. And I give some of the backstory of the competition. So that's a little bit of a, I guess, an autobiography. I have been writing for many years now a book about my life, but I haven't finished it. But if I ever do it and there's any interest in it, I'll let you know about that for sure. And I would love to go to Australia for a seminar. I've never been to Australia. I hear they're really locked down, though, out there. If they ever open up after this COVID thing is finally over, if it ever ends, I would love to go out there for a seminar. That would be great. This letter says, "Hey, John, just a personal thank you from me for organizing the tribute podcast to Chris Dickerson. I felt quite emotional by the end of it. I think that episode epitomizes why we need to take time to reflect and remember legends like Chris, Boyer and Roy, Boyer Coe and Roy Callender, both in their mid-70s themselves, were a good choice. Great stories and kind words. Take care, John, Mike." All right. Thank you, Mike. I'm glad you like that. Yeah, I thought that turned out good. We tried to give a good historical tribute to Chris, and I thought he deserved it because he was such a legendary bodybuilder. We had to do something. So I agree with you. I think Boyer and Roy Callender were great guests, and those guys competed with Chris since the 1960s and 70s. So long history competing with Chris Dickerson, and I think they did a great job. And also Bill Nealon, who was a good friend of Chris for the last 20 years. And he lives out here in Florida, so he was always with Chris. So all three of those guys were great guests. And this email says, "Hey, John, great work on the Chris Dickerson tribute show. It was great that you mentioned Chris's success in the many Grand Prix shows. Bodybuilding was an interesting sport to follow in those days, as there were a group of guys that regularly competed, and this created ongoing interest in the sport. Too often in bodybuilding, you only see someone compete once or twice a year. Regards, Jim Kerr. P.S. I know you're a big fan of the original Pumping Iron movie. Last week, I came across an interview with the shorter bodybuilder that was given posing advice by Arnold in the movie. The guy is actually very interesting, and he has some great stories to tell. Check it out." Yeah, I did see that interview, and it was really interesting. He talked about hanging out with Arnold. That's from a site called builtreport.com. If you guys want to check it out, I think that's a website, but it's also on YouTube. And then finally, one more here, and it says, "Hey, John, nice interview with Wes Brown, the guy who Arnold helps with his posing and Pumping Iron." Oh, okay. Same video. "It might be a good guest for your show. Lots of interesting stuff about the movie that I've never heard here before." And he's got the YouTube link here. He said, "This is pretty deep in the Pumping Iron weeds, but some interesting stuff. I hope you're well." Yeah, I would love to interview that guy, Wes. I just need to get a hold of him. I checked out the interview, but didn't have any contact information for him. But if I could find him, yeah, I'd love to interview him for the podcast. He would be a really great interview, and he's definitely a part of history because he was in the movie Pumping Iron. All right. I think that's all I got for you guys right now. We're still working on that seminar out in Massachusetts, so I'll let you know about that when it becomes available. We don't really have a date yet, but it should be either March or April. So me and the gym owner are trying to figure it out. We want to give it enough time to advertise it. But yeah, it should be like late March, maybe early April. So as soon as I know about it, I will let everybody know. And if anyone's out there, hopefully you can make it out there. That'd be great. It's going to be a big 2-day seminar, and it's going to include training portion. So we're going to start with, I'm going to demonstrate all these different bodybuilding exercises, and then we'll have a lecture portion. So it will definitely be worth your money, because it's going to be a big 2-day seminar. All right. Okay, that's all I got for opening, guys. Here is part one of our interview with Jerry Branham, who is a former writer for Muscle and Fitness Magazine and Iron Man Magazine. Jerry worked for all the magazines and met all these guys. And we're going to talk about the year 1991. We're going to go back 30 years, and this will be part one of our interview. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have my good friend Jerry Branham with me again today, and we are continuing our year-end discussion where we go back 30 years, 40 years, and 50 years. And this will be our last year, Jerry. We've covered 1971, and then we did 1981. So now we're up to 1991. So going 30 years back, we're in the 1990s, which is unbelievable, but time keeps moving forward.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about, of course, the 1991 Mr. Olympia today, Jerry, and that was Lee Haney's last Mr. Olympia. So that was an historic event, but there's also a lot of other big contests that took place in 1991, including the MPC Nationals, which Kevin Lavroni won. And then we got the 1991 Ironman Pro, which you and I used to both work for Ironman Magazine.
Right.
And that was the second year they had that show. And then the 1991 Arnold Classic, which Sean Ray won. And then the 1991 Night of the Champions, which Dorian Yates won.
Right.
But before we get into that, we seem to talk about this every week now on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We always have a couple of bodybuilders pass away. So we had a relatively younger guy, Tom Prince, pass away. And we also had Marvin Etter, who was 90 years old. So let's talk about Tom Prince first, Jerry, because you knew Tom Prince, and he was only 52 years old. And I know that he had kidney issues before, and I think he lost his kidney, but he died of cancer, from what I heard.
Right. Well, with Tom, I met Tom. I know that he won the NPC Nationals. I believe it was 97. Do I have
97? Yeah, you're right.
But I think I met him before that. I don't know if you have the record. I think if he competed in any nationals before that.
Yeah, he took second in 95, and then he was second in 96.
Okay.
And second in also the USA in 96. I think that was to Craig Titus. I remember that one.
Yeah.
So and then he won the 97 nationals overall.
Okay, so then I met him in 95 because I know he didn't.
Okay.
When I met him, I interviewed him at the contest, and I found right away he was a very intelligent guy, great build, and this and that. And of course, he started training at Gold's Gym. And, you know, as I said, this guy was huge to me. I mean, in the off season, he was like 5'8", and he'd be over 300 pounds. I mean, think about that. I mean, picture in your mind an average man. 5'8", weighing 300 pounds. They'd be so fat, they'd roll down the street.
Yeah.
All muscle. I mean, wow. I used to comment, I used to say to him, Tom, you know, I looked at his bone structure. He seemed to have like a massive bone structure that, I mean, like I call them dinosaur bones because it could support so much muscle, you know?
Yeah.
And he lifted very heavy. I saw him do dips with 200 pounds attached to his waist. I've never seen anybody at Gold's Gym use that much weight in dips.
And he had huge legs too, right?
Had huge legs. Everything was heavy, heavy, heavy. And, you know, a couple of years later, he had, as most people know, if they know anything about Tom Prince, he went into kidney failure.
Right.
He had to have a kidney transplant. But before that, I think he had already retired from bodybuilding even before that happened. But I asked him about that. I asked him, what do you think caused the kidney problems? Because, you know, some of the bodybuilders seem to have kidney problems. I mean, they say that Nasser al-Sambadi died of a kidney problem because Flex Wheeler has a kidney problem. And so I wanted to see where his kidney problem came from, because a lot of people believe that the bodybuilders get kidney problems or kidney failure because of the heavy steroid use.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't deny using steroids. I didn't ask him for his steroid routine. I said, Tom, what do you think caused your kidney failure? What he told me at the time was all that heavy lifting he did. I mean, the man trained heavy all the time.
Yeah.
This is not a guy who lifted light weights. He said he had his joints was so sore all the time that he had a habit of taking a lot of tablets of ibuprofen.
Oh.
non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. You know, we know it as, what's the common name for that?
Advil.
Yeah, Advil. Uh-huh. And he was taking, believe it or not, 12 to 15 tablets a day.
Mm.
What he didn't know, and this is a medical fact, when you take large amounts of that drug, it destroys your kidneys over time. It just destroys them.
Mm.
So he, at the time he, I spoke to him, he attributed his kidney failure to his, he said he did this for like 3 years in a row, taking this massive ibuprofen. But it turns out, I found out later, this is interesting. What happened was he had a kidney transplant. When I ran into him long after he retired at Goals, he was almost unrecognizable. He was very thin. He used to have these big, broad shoulders. He had little, tiny shoulders.
Mm.
He looked like he weighed maybe 150 at the most.
Yeah, right? It was an amazing transformation.
Right. And but, you know, I said, how you doing, Tom? We spoke for a while. I asked him what he was doing. He told me he was into real estate and he was doing very well. He was doing, he seemed very happy. Mm. And this, I asked him if he trained. He said occasionally, you know, but when I saw him, he wasn't training. He just happened to be in the front of the gym. I don't know why he was there, but it turns out that Tom had the same disease that Flex Wheeler had. It's called focal glomerular something sclerosis. It's basically caused by a buildup of scar tissue in the liver that destroys the kidney filtering units, the nephrons, to the point where you have to have a kidney transplant or you could die. Now, Flex said it was genetic, and so did Tom. Because Tom said the original kidneys that he got transplanted failed, and he had to get another kidney transplant.
Oh, man.
And that failed too. And then he realized, it turns out some doctors or nephrologists that knew more about it explained to him that his blood contained he didn't know what it was, but I know what it was. It's called immunoglobulin M, and that selectively destroys the kidney. It's an autoimmune effect that, so in other words, he could have kept putting in more kidneys and they kept would have failing. So, jeez. So at the time of his death, he still had the kidney transplant, but it wasn't working. He was in kidney failure. He had to go to dialysis 3 times a week, 4 hours at a time. See, but strangely enough, it wasn't the kidney. He didn't die of kidney failure. He died of cancer.
Right.
But what kind of cancer he had, I don't know. But I'm wondering if maybe, possibly, I don't want to even speculate, but, you know, it could have been kidney cancer. But I don't know. I have no idea. But
yeah.
I know he died of kidney, and I know that the last couple of months of his life, unfortunately, he was, you know, certain types of cancer, you get something called cachexia, where your body kind of eats itself away, you know.
Mm.
Unfortunately, he was like that. He kind of like had the last couple of months, whatever, he had it really bad. He more or less, you know, his body ate itself up, and then he died. It's a tragic. Because Tom was an intelligent guy. He had a master's degree in English literature. And for a while, when I spoke to him, when I met him at the Nationals in 95, I think he was living in Florida, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure. Okay. But I remember he said he was teaching. And right away, that struck a note. I said, wow, a guy like this monster bodybuilder. Frank Zane was a teacher, too, you know.
Right.
And, of course, Richard Baldwin, our mutual friend, he was a college professor, you know. But, you know, right away, it struck me. I admired. He seemed like a Renaissance man. He had the
great
physique. He spoke well. He was intelligent, you know. I mean, I used to talk to him when I'd go to the gym. Always a friendly, nice guy.
Yeah.
Like you had to see this guy in person in the off season to realize he was thick. I mean, he rivaled guys like Paul Dillette. He was huge. He wasn't as tall as Dillette. Dillette was like 6 foot. But I mean, he was just so thick. And I used to look at him and he's always training heavy. I'm thinking, how can he train heavy like that all the time and not have injuries? See, what I didn't know was he did have injuries. I didn't find because I really think that, you know, he was much younger then, of course, but I really believe you can't train. And Dorian Yates said the same thing. You can't train with super heavy weights all the time and not get an injury. Sooner or later, something to give. I mean, Dorian himself, in interviews, he said the reason he retired from bodybuilding competition was not that he was afraid of Ronnie Coleman or anyone else. He had so many injuries that he felt that he couldn't train at 100% effort.
Right.
So if he couldn't come in at 100%, he was done. He was finished.
And,
you know, and he was loath to say it because, you know, he didn't want to say his training system was bad, meaning high intensity to failure, you know, blah, blah. But, you know, he kind of hinted that, you know, the heavy weights kind of did it. So, yeah. You know, and that's what happens. I mean, I guess he wanted to be big, Tom, and he felt that heavy weights was, which is a certain amount is true. You know, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
That you lift heavy, usually you get bigger muscles. I mean, you know, although there's a big controversy now in exercise, they're now saying that, and you've seen this too, John. How many bodybuilders have you seen that you see them in the gym? They're huge guys, and you expect them to be lifting really heavy weights. Mm. And you have to train, and they're using these ridiculously light weights for them. I mean, for them. For someone else, it might be moderate weight, but for these huge guys, and yet they're huge. You wonder, but it turns out you can have big muscles and not necessarily have the strength to go with it. Mm. In other words, it's not always the same. I mean, we've seen a lot of Olympic weightlifters, power lifters, they hoist really heavy weights, but these guys don't have 22-inch arms.
Right.
16-inch arms.
Yeah. You
know, but in other words, so they don't always go together. But in Tom's case, he felt that lifting heavy weights was the way to go. And I'll tell you, the guy was a great guy. I felt bad when I heard that he died. Really nice guy.
Yeah. He didn't really have much of a pro career. He got third place at the Night of the Champions in 2001.
Right.
I think that was his highest placing.
Let me ask you, John, your opinion. You're a good observer of bodybuilding. I look at the guy. You've seen the photos of him in top shape.
Yeah.
And I noticed, too, that his pro career was less than stellar, let's say, right?
Yeah.
How do you attribute that? What was wrong with the guy? I mean, I watched after I heard he died, I found a thing on YouTube of him posing at one of the shows.
Mm-hmm.
I really couldn't see any weak points. I mean, why?
Yeah, I couldn't either. I know he had really huge legs and he was super thick. And he always got high praise from everybody. So maybe he was never in condition, because I'm looking at some of his placings here.
Yeah.
Like his first Night of the Champions, he got 13th.
Yeah.
And then he got third in 2001. And then the Arnold Classic, he got 11th. The Ironman Pro, he got 9th. The only Olympia he ever did, he got 16th. So, yeah, he never did that well.
I think it must be, I think you hit the nail on the head. He probably looked a little soft.
Yeah.
He probably wasn't as ripped as the other guys. You know, he did. And even though he was huge and obviously wasn't fat, but he wasn't kind of like super defined, shredded.
Yeah.
Like the guy. So they kind of placed him low because he wasn't missing any body parts. From what I could see, he had calves, he had thighs. He had gigantic leg. I mean, God, you ever seen
leg biceps? I remember that. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Everybody always talked about that. Yeah.
He had one of the biggest hamstring develop I've ever seen in bodybuilding. So it wasn't that he lacked muscle. It had to be, as you said, maybe the conditioning wasn't up to par. Compared
to
because the guy had no weak points.
Right. Yeah.
But just that. That's the only reason he could have placed that.
Maybe he could have been a little wider, maybe, you know.
Yeah, that's true, too. Yeah.
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 You know, it seems like, though, I just talked about this on one of my social media pages about like Ronnie Coleman and Dorian Yates and how they both train so heavy. And for their time, they were the biggest in their generation. So it does seem like we're going to talk about Marvin Etter in a second. And he was a groundbreaking bodybuilder for his time. Yeah. But it seems like you really do kind of got to train heavy in order to develop the size, right?
Yeah. Well, the way it works, I just actually talked about this just the other day. You know, you take for something like training to failure, which is a common
population.
In other words, when you do a set, you do it to complete failure, right?
Right.
What the current science shows about that is if you want to train light, let's say 30 to 40% of one rep max, that's lightweight.
That's very light, yeah.
You got to do like 20 to 30 reps, right? Because you got to build up what they call metabolic stress.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do it to failure each set, because if you don't, you're not going to get the muscle fibers like type 2X muscle fibers. Those are the muscle fibers that are most amenable to growth. Now, here's the difference. When you lift heavy weights, you don't have to go to failure.
Mm.
Because the way the body works, it's called the Henneman's recruitment principle. The body recruits only as many muscle fibers as necessary to complete the movement.
Right.
Now, the body can sense when you're lifting heavy weights, so it throws in the whole ball game. In other words, you get all the muscle fibers. You don't have to go to failure.
You're automatically.
Now, think about it. The more muscle fibers you involve, the greater the chance of muscle damage and consequent hypertrophy or growth. So, you know, I kind of don't buy, you know, what I said earlier about some of the scientists saying strength and muscle don't go. From my personal experience, I think you'll agree, I believe there is a definite relationship between strength and muscle. I know that when I, not anymore, but when I was strong years ago, my muscle size was almost a direct relationship to how much weight I was lifting.
Yeah.
Like I once made a bet with a guy, because my legs were always very responsive, my thighs. I said to him, I'll bet you I could put an inch on my thigh in 1 month. He says, no way, because I already had pretty big legs. All I did is do change my squat routine around, where I did a combination of heavy weight and high reps. I did heavy weight for like 4 sets. And then I finished off the set. You're not going to believe this. With 1 set of 225 pounds, I did 50 reps.
Wow.
I did that in every thigh workout.
Damn.
At the end of the month, I had put an inch and a half on my thighs. I knew it, you know?
So right.
The point is, to answer your question, I believe that all things being equal, yes. In other words, the stronger you are, and of course, there's a genetic component too. Ronnie Coleman and Dorian Yates were genetic freaks who would respond very well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys, like I say, who can still be strong, but not show that kind of development. They can be phenomenally strong, but not show that kind of, you have to have the genetic component too.
Yeah.
So, but generally speaking, I believe there's a direct relationship between strength and muscle size. If you're, if you're not going to push the weight at all, you know, you could do, you can get, you know, like the science says that you can get the same amount of muscle size doing that system I just told you, you know, 20 to 30 reps to failure. But, you know, the truth is most guys or most people will not go to failure. If you don't go to failure when you're doing that, you're not going to get the gains. Whereas when you lift heavy weights, you don't have to think about it. It's automatic.
That makes sense. Yeah.
You have no choice. You're not going to be able to finish the set unless you recruit those fibers.
Right, right.
So if you add it all up, the chances of getting bigger from lifting heavier versus the lightweight to failure is much greater with the heavier weights because it's automatic.
Yeah.
You don't have to, and you don't even, like I said, you don't have to go to failure. Now you all you have to do is lift it. You stop.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, I've seen it over and over again.
Because even if you go way back to Reg Park and Bill Pearl, those guys lifted heavy. You know, they were the biggest guys in their generation too.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, when we talk about Marvin, we could talk about how he trained with Reg Park.
Yeah.
When Reg Park came to New York, they trained together.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
We might as well slip right into Marvin.
All right.
I'll tell you a quick story about him. I knew who he was, right? He was famous. When I was training back in New York as a teenager at R&J Health Studio, he would occasionally come by there, but he didn't work out. He just stopped by. He would visit Julie Levine, who was the owner of the gym. And one time I saw him, he was a plumber, and I saw him. I was working out in the gym, you know, it was a small gym. People might, if anyone who watches the movie Pumping Iron, the scenes of Louis Ferrigno training with his father.
Yeah.
That was R&J Health Studio. That was the gym he was training. But anyway, he showed up one day, and I remember he walked up to there was an Olympic bar. It had about maybe 295, 300 pounds on there, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was in a plumber's uniform, wasn't in workout clothes. I remember he went up to it, he cleaned it, and he pressed it. And
like,
I mean, when I say pressed it, I don't mean he went like this. It was like this.
Wow.
Like, if you didn't know better, you'd think there was a fake weight on the bar.
Oh, my God.
I was like 15, 16 years old. My jaw dropped because I knew who this guy was. You know, he was preceded by his reputation, like they say.
Yeah.
But when I saw the strength, that raw strength, and this is a guy who hadn't trained in years.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, because see, Marvin Eden got a raw deal because he was an up-and-coming guy in the early, like around 1950 or so. I think when he was 19, I think it was 49 or something, 40, he got second in a national contest. I don't remember if it was Junior America. I don't remember which one. But he was up-and-coming. But unfortunately, at that time, WIDA was starting his organization. The IFBB was beginning.
Yeah.
AAU had a kind of clash with IFBB and blah, blah. Anyway, to make a long story short, Marvin Eden got caught in the trap. He was an innocent victim. I don't know whether he did a posing exhibition or some say it was a posing exhibition for the IFBB where he got $15 he got paid.
Yeah.
Other stories say it was because he competed in the IFBB contest. I'm not sure which one it was, but I know that the AAU kind of like gave him a hard time. I don't know whether they banned him or what.
Yeah. But
his bodybuilding career, he was disgusted by the whole thing and he didn't want to deal with it and he quit bodybuilding.
Yeah, you know, yeah. You're exactly right, Joe. I got this book. I'll read it right here. It says he was inspired by John Grimmick. He began strength training at 15 years old as a member of the East Side Barbell Club in Brooklyn. And then in 1948, he placed second at the IFBB Junior Mr. America. And he won his division at the IFBB Junior North America Weightlifting Championship. And then it said 1950, Marvin captured the IFBB Mr. Eastern America. And in 1951, got third place at the AAU Mr. America. And then in 1952, he was declared a professional athlete by the AAU over a disputed $15 guest appearance. You got it. And he said he was so devastated by that ruling that he quit competitive heavy lifting. This tragedy cost the United States one of its best 98-pound lifters and bodybuilding one of its most inspirational up-and-coming superstars.
Yep. Yeah, that's true. You see, that's the thing. Marvin was not only a great bodybuilder for his time, but he had this phenomenal raw strength. And
yeah.
And, you know, and before, I know some people will say, well, he took steroids. He didn't take steroids. I mean, come on. I saw the guy when he was probably in his maybe 40s, had trained in years and comes up and lifts 300 pounds like a waste nothing. This guy was just a natural genetic strength freak.
Yeah. And
he did dips. I mentioned earlier that what was the guy? I forgot his
name. Tom Prince. Yeah.
Tom Prince. I mentioned how I saw him do dips with 200 pounds. Well, I didn't see this, but apparently Marvin Eater actually did dips with 436 pounds in addition to his 200-pound body. I mean, I don't. Maybe the body weight was included. I'm not sure, but I know he did dips with 436 pounds.
Yeah, and you're right. You're right.
Nobody has ever duplicated that, to my knowledge.
No, that's an incredible amount of weight. That's unbelievable. Yeah.
Anybody who you don't even have to work out, try just go to a parallel bar, do dips. Imagine having over 400 pounds of
dips. Grip your shoulders up.
And at a body weight of about maybe 198, I believe it was.
Right, right.
He was like one of the first bodybuilders to bench press 500 pounds.
Yeah.
500 pounds, and he's like just under 200 pounds. He and when Reg Park, of course, the great Reg Park, who won four Mr. Universe titles. He came to New York, and they trained together. I believe I might have been at Abe Goldberg's gym in New York. I'm not sure which gym it was, but they trained together. And Reg and Marvin had a good relationship because, you know, Reg was also prodigiously strong. He was something like the third bodybuilder or third man in the world to bench press 500. Also,
he was third, yeah.
And the way they did it, John, it was they you know, let's say I'm doing a bench press, I take it off here. I go down like this, right? Touch the chest and head and hold it for a second, then press it up. There was no bouncing or
right.
Special suits with like a rubber suit where you bounce. This was pure raw strength. So Reg was like second or third bodybuilder to do 500. And Marvin Eater was basically the only guy who could keep up with him.
Because yeah. Reg
was another guy that loved to train heavy. His favorite routine for size was what he called the 5-5-5-5-5.
Right.
Five sets of five reps. He liked to lift very heavy. That's how he built the size. And Marvin was the only guy who could, you know, these guys would be doing like 70-pound curls. Marvin Eater, another phenomenal lift. He was able to do side laterals with 120 pounds in each.
Holy cow. That's especially during that time. That's unbelievable. Yeah.
Now, I thought I was strong when I was doing the high intensity system in around 1970, 71. I built up to where I was able to do 60 pounds strict side lateral.
Yeah.
I thought that was phenomenal. I said,
yeah.
Who can do side laterals with 60 pounds?
Right.
He did twice as much. I wasn't on drugs, but that's not the point. The point is I weighed like 225. He weighed 198. He's using much more weight than.
Yeah, yeah.
The guy was just phenomenally strong. Absolutely. I mean.
Yeah, it says here, at a height of 5'8", weighing under 200 pounds, Eater became the third person to officially bench press 500 pounds.
Right.
It was not until the steroid era began that anyone of Eater's body weight bench pressed that amount. In 1953, at a weight of 198 pounds, Marvin unofficially clean and pressed 355 pounds, a weight above the world record. He also accomplished a parallel bar dip of 450 435 pounds, you're right, yeah. Jerry, yeah. While weighing 198 pounds of feet, which has never been equal.
Nobody's equaled that. I don't know if anyone ever will. You know, the guy was just absolute. You know, it makes me think, John. I mean, this is a guy who I totally believe. I mean, he in interviews. I mean, I saw the guy in person a couple, but I never really spoke to him. But in interviews, he's shown like Reg Park and others of his era. Reg Park, Steve Reeves, they were dead set against steroids. They were disgusted the way the bodybuilding had progressed to the point where the guy took huge amounts of anabolic drug. But I can't help wondering what would happen if a guy, Marvin Eder, had you.
I know.
I mean, he had this amount of strength naturally. What if he took the? He said, "I mean, my God, he either would have torn his the muscles off the bones." I mean, seriously, this guy was. It's mind-boggling to think about it. You know. So Artie Zeller, you know, the famous photographer Artie Zeller, who was a lot of people don't know this, but Artie Zeller was a bodybuilder himself. And he trained with Marvin Eder at the Abe Goldberg gym in the early 50s. Artie used to tell me a lot of stories about Marvin Eder. Unfortunately, I don't remember a lot of them. But I remember Artie telling me about a guy at the gym who used to carry the picture of that still makes me laugh. This guy would carry a sandwich in his wallet. He would keep a sandwich. I don't know if it was Marvin Eder or somebody else. I can't remember. But somebody in that gym would walk around, always carry a sandwich in his wallet. I know. That's what Artie told me. Mm-hmm. Artie used to tell me about some of the strength feats of Marvin. So they were true. He was an eyewitness.
It says Reg Park said of Marvin, "We had a lot in common. We were more strength athletes than bodybuilders. We had great workouts at Abe Goldberg's gym in New York. We used 120-pound dumbbells for seated presses and did barbell rows with 400 pounds.
Right.
He said, Eder remarked, Reg Park was one of the few able to keep up with him during a workout.
Yeah, so
we were squatting 475 pounds for two sets of eight reps and 520 pounds for triples.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not many bodybuilders today that can even come close to those.
I know. Like you said, he was talking about the drugs. He said, health was never divorced from my training. I've never, under any circumstances, considered the use of artificial drugs to stimulate my muscle growth. What's going on now is a nightmare, an obscenity. In a way, I hope the whole thing disappears, but it's getting worse with time. I will not lend my presence to any show, even if they were to honor me. That's in the past. I don't care what present bodybuilders' goals are. You want to get muscular and strong, work out hard, and look after yourself like I did. Still, you can't beat genetics. Can everyone be an Einstein? No, they can't.
Right. Well, that kind of reminds me of what Reg told me, Reg Park. He told me that, he was a life bodybuilder, but he told me he didn't like going to bodybuilding contests. The only one that he attended in his later years was the Arnold contest, because Arnold was kind of his protege.
Yeah.
So he did that as a favor. But you know, the thing is, I asked him why, Rich. He says, I can't stand the look of these guys.
Yeah.
The bloated bellies. He says, there's no aesthetics anymore.
Right.
There's no symmetry. He says, it just turns my stomach. I can't look at it.
So, yeah, they came from such a different era.
Yeah. I mean, in those days, you look at the old photos, look at pictures of Marvin Eder. I mean, he wasn't the biggest guy, but he had a nice aesthetic physique. He had great abs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had most of the body parts together. He wasn't overly huge, but there was nothing really artificial looking about the guy. They didn't have bloated belly, nothing like that.
Right.
I mean, and the truth of the matter is, you look at, unfortunately, Reg sadly died of cancer prematurely. He could have probably lived a lot longer.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Marvin made it to 90. And the thing is that I wonder if, you know, the guys today with the drug use today, are they going to make it to 90?
No way.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think there's a price to be paid.
Yeah, there's got to be, right?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I read the medical journals related to a lot of, you know, the steroid use. Each year they're finding more and more things that happen when you take steroids long-term that they didn't know years ago.
Yeah.
Such as this calcium buildup in the coronary arteries, changes in the structure of the heart, precancerous changes.
Yeah.
Like I think I might have mentioned to you about the trenbolone, how it can cause changes in the brain.
Right.
Up for Alzheimer's disease. I mean, you know, it's going to catch up with these guys. I don't want it to happen, but I don't want to mention any names, but some of these guys that are competing in the Olympia today, some of these really big guys, to me, it's like dead man walking when I look at
them. Yeah, I know.
I mean, there's one young guy, I don't know the man personally, I don't want to embarrass him, but when I look at him, it kind of creeps me out. He's huge. He's got tremendous, he's got more size than I could ever dream of. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But what is he doing to get that size? I mean, you know, this. I know he works out hard, but,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he stays big all the time. I mean,
and he's bigger than ever. And he keeps getting bigger and bigger.
I mean, I know in his head, you know, he just fired one of his trainers.
Coach.
Yeah. There's rumors are that maybe the coach didn't like his PED program. I don't know what, we don't really know what the reason was, but the point is that in this guy's minds, the goal is to get bigger and bigger and bigger to win the contest.
Yeah.
But it's like blowing up a balloon, you know, you keep blowing it up. The balloon gets bigger and bigger. Then what happens? It blows up.
Yeah. Well, he said his goal is to win the Olympia 10 times.
Well, hey, more power to him if he does.
He'll never last that long.
He'll never last that long because, as we have, you and I have discussed many times, John, one of the keys to winning the Olympia, year after year, is you have to show some improvement.
Yeah.
Or at least at the very minimum, you have to reach this at least the same peak condition you did the year before. If you backslide, you're going to lose.
You're going to lose. Yeah.
This would happen to Samir Benoud, Chris Dickens, a couple other guys. They just didn't get that.
Even Phil Heath, eventually.
Phil Heath, a good example. Yeah. They, you know, and the pressure on your body is just so much. I mean,
well, that's the other thing. You know, when we just did a tribute about Chris Dickerson, and I had Boyer Coe on, and one of the things I was saying to Boyer Coe was, I go, it's amazing when you look at your career, Boyer, because him and Chris were competing for 30 years.
Right.
They started competing in the 60s, and they went all the way up to the 90s. These guys today will never last 30 years.
I don't think so.
Their body can't handle – it doesn't respond to the drugs anymore, you know, because they're taking so many drugs.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. I've seen that happen with relatively conservative drug programs. I've seen famous bodybuilders – I'll give you a name. I'll actually – the guy's retired, so I'm sure he wouldn't mind. Do you remember a guy named Phil Hill, I believe his name was?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Huge black guy. I mean, massive, massive guy. He came up to me. I was covering the Night of the Champions for WIDA one year in New York. This would be the 90s. And he kind of disappeared from the bodybuilding. He came on like a thunderstorm.
Yeah, didn't last long.
I mean, this guy was just, you look at photos. Anyone watching this, Google this guy and look at the photos. He was tremendous. Huge legs. He just disappeared.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting in a restaurant. Who walks up to me? I had interviewed him when he was competing, so he knew who I was. He comes up to me. He says, Jerry, mind if we talk? I said, sure, sit down, Phil. And we started talking, and I said, what happened to you, man? I said, you were going strong. I thought you were going to be like Mr. Olympia. I had you as one of the top guys. He says, between me and you, Jerry, off the record, he says, my body didn't respond to drugs. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
I didn't know what happened. I was taking the drugs as I always did, and it just didn't work after a while. I don't know why. It just didn't work, and I had to drop out because I just didn't feel I was in top shape. That's what he told me. I never forgot. Yeah,
that was over 30 years ago.
That was
what they're doing now.
Yeah, that was, and he was on like probably a conservative program.
Yeah.
And I've heard the same story from guys going right back to the 70s when they hardly, when the, you know, the steroid programs that Arnold and his contemporaries, that was candy compared to the
what. Yeah. Yeah.
Still, after a while, it didn't work as well.
See? Yeah. Yeah.
That's what Frank Zane in interviews today. He often talks about how he never relied on steroids.
Yeah.
In other words, Frank, what he's saying is he's not denying using steroids. He's saying he used a minimal amount.
Right.
He never depended on them. You know, but you see, after then, Frank wasn't trying to be big anyway.
Right.
He perfected, defined. In other words, so it was easy for him. He didn't have to take a lot of stuff because that was not his goal.
Right.
He himself said that once he got over 200 pounds, his kind of strength disappeared. He just started to look smooth, and he wasn't a big guy. Unless he was cut and ripped, he was not a winning physique. Right. He had really hard shape. So he took a minimal amount of steroids. But the point is that he never relied on them. See, yeah. Whereas the difference is today, I believe there's a much greater reliance
on drugs
than he had back then. In other words, today, drugs are a big, big part of these guys' preparation and bodybuilding program.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why. It just seems like it's a slippery slope because it's like it keeps getting worse. And if we talk about the 80s and 90s, we're talking mostly about anabolic steroid use. We're not talking about growth hormones. We're not talking about insulin. And who knows what effects that's going to have on the body, right?
That's true.
It's relatively new where we don't know what the effects are going to be.
Insulin really didn't come into bodybuilding until the early to mid-90s.
90s, right.
And the only insulin use before that I know of was Tim Belknap, but he was type 1 diabetic. He didn't use it for bodybuilding. He used it to stay alive.
Right, right.
Use it as an anabolic drug, but and of course Dorian Yates says in interviews that he felt his use of insulin was a big mistake because it kind of tended to simulate fat and made him smooth.
Yeah,
he didn't see any benefit from it. And if you look at the attributes of insulin, what it does, it's a fat storing hormone.
Yeah,
so it's a slippery slope. I mean, I know there's certain people. Some of these guys are friends of mine. I don't want to embarrass, but there's certain people that are coaches today that advocate fairly huge amounts of insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, it can go wrong real easy with insulin.
Yeah.
It's extremely fat stimulating insulin, extremely fat stimulating. It is the most fat stimulating hormone in the body.
Yeah.
It forces your body to store fat.
But it can also be anabolic if you take it right.
It can be anabolic, especially when combined with like growth hormone.
Yeah.
And also, insulin is only anabolic in the presence of large amounts of amino acids. Without a large amount of amino acids, insulin is what they call anti-catabolic.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to prevent the breakdown of muscle. That's true. So, if you look at it from bodybuilding perspective, the main advantage of insulin would not be to put size on, it'd be two reasons: to counter the effects of growth hormone. Growth hormone stimulates elevated blood glucose. Insulin lowers it. So insulin would counter the side effect of growth hormone. The secondary effect is that insulin, it really will help you maintain muscle under dieting conditions. It will.
Right.
But again, you got that problem where you just step over the line a little bit. It can make you smooth because it also stimulates a adrenal steroid hormone called aldosterone.
Mm-hmm.
Which your body to retain salt and water, so it's a real, real fine line there,
Yeah.
I agree with Dorian. I mean, I think most bodybuilders should keep away from insulin.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. One other thing, it stimulates glycogen synthesis in the muscle.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Yeah,
will make the muscle look thick. You have a thicker look. It does do that too.
Right. Yeah. Right. I'll tell you. I don't know if I ever told you a story about Dorian Yates. Now, I started bodybuilding in 77, so I had been in bodybuilding for almost 20 years, but I saw him guest pose in 1994 in Chicago. They had the Junior Mr. USA contest in Chicago, and Dorian was guest posing. Now, Dorian had won the Olympia twice in 92 and 93. So he was guest posing. I remember the show was in May, and everybody was talking about, you got to see this guy in the off season. He's like over 300 pounds. He's unbelievable. I remember J.M. Mannion was telling me a story. He went to pick him up at the airport. He had a Jeep and he said he was so thick, the seatbelt wouldn't even fit around him in the Jeep. He was like this thick, So anyways, he comes out and he poses and he was so big. And I don't mean muscularly big. I had seen Sergio guest pose before. So I saw one of the best, and I had seen big bodybuilders pose before. I've been to Olympia and stuff,
Yeah.
I never saw a physique like Dorian. It was almost disgusting. It was almost like, I remember even his bones were big. His knees were big and his calves were so big. And my jaw hit the floor, but it wasn't like, remember how you used to talk about Arnold in 74, how he looked like a Greek god.
Right.
Dorian didn't look like a Greek guy. I mean, no disrespect to Dorian. I really admire him. And I've interviewed him before, and I think he's a great interview and everything. But he just looked disgusting. It looked over the line. It looked like too much.
Like almost like a caricature, right?
Yeah, it didn't look human. It was the first bodybuilder I saw And this is the early 90s. So now, you know, of course, many bodybuilders came after that. I mean, this was the start of it, right? Yeah. But I remember I was just so freaked out. It didn't look right. It didn't look human. And they, I remember they had an intermission right after he guest posed. And I went out into the lobby and I was talking to all these bodybuilder friends that I knew from Chicago, guys who worked out at other gyms, competitors and stuff. And everybody had the same opinion. They were like, that was too much. It was too much. It was like freaky. It was, but not freaky in a good way.
Right.
It was like, I had seen Tim Belknap and I thought that was freaky, but it was like impressive.
Yeah.
To me, Dorian was, it was too much. And I remember saying to somebody, I said, well, that must be what happens when you combine high amounts of growth hormone with steroids.
Right. Yeah. That's about right.
That was like, to me, that was the first time I'd seen that. And I saw Lee Haney pose before. He didn't look like that. Yeah. I mean, it was like another level. It was a different type of person.
Did you ever see, I didn't see this in person, photos of Ronnie Coleman posing in the off season? What he looked like?
I saw him pose too in the off season. Yeah.
He claimed to weigh 330 pounds.
Yeah.
And when I saw him, I just couldn't believe my eyes.
Right.
His stomach was immense.
Right. And
it came out like, you know, but you could see the guy had, he still had the, you know, the, you clearly see the delts in the off.
Yeah.
He was huge.
Yeah. I mean,
his legs look like 45 inch
tall. I know. Well, that was when I first saw him. I had seen pictures of him in the Olympia, so I knew he had the big back and the big arms, and I was expecting to see that. I could not believe the legs. He looked, he's 5'11". He looked like he was 5'2" on stage because his legs were so enormous.
Yeah.
I had never seen legs like that before. It was unbelievable.
But can you imagine if Ronnie Coleman was guest posing at a contest, and before the contest started, they opened with the guest poser, which was Ronnie Coleman. And let's say you brought a friend or a woman or someone and you say, who'd never seen a bodybuilding contest.
Right.
And she sits there and the curtain opens. There's Ronnie Coleman with the big stomach.
Right.
And she turns to you and says, John, is this what a bodybuilder
looks? I know.
How do you explain? It reminds me of the time I was at a contest years ago. I was sitting in the audience next to a guy who was there with his wife, I think it was. And the guy posing, we were close enough where we could see. The guy turns to the back. He does a back shot. And he's got severe cystic acne all over his back, right? It looks like a map of the stars. You know what I mean? All over.
Yeah.
Big red, you know, zits all over his back. So she turns to me. She says, is that normal, Jerry, in bodybuilding for those, you know, whatever that is, those red things on his back. I said, no. I said, that usually indicates a heavy steroid use. I said, that is not normal at all. You know what I mean? She didn't know. I mean, she thought maybe it went along with when you get big muscles, you get zits all over you.
Right. But I think when the physique started getting like that, that's when we lost it. That's when it went too far, you know.
It is. I mean, is there anyone today, John? I know there's a little tangential to what we're going to talk about, but is there any pro bodybuilder, let's talk about the Olympia, that you think comes the closest to having, let's say, a throwback physique or a physique that, you know, they could say that would be more attractive to most people, even bodybuilders? Yeah. Is there anyone you could think of?
Well, you know, like I said, I thought Sean Roden kind of looked like that. And
Sean was like that. He was.
Yeah, because he had that small, tight waist, you know. Yeah. And I always liked Cedric McMillan's physique, although I think that was the physique of years ago. I don't think we're going to see his physique being at the top anymore. You know, I think he's kind of past his prime, you know.
Yeah, I agree, though, with both guys. But, I mean, I can't think of any. That's why I asked you. I can't think of any guys that don't look kind of blown up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're all like that. Yeah, they're all like that.
You know, and it concerns me because I don't want to see anyone get sick. But when I look at that, I can't help thinking, what are these guys doing to get that look?
Oh, you know, the other one that looks good, I thought, is that Patrick Moore. Did you ever see Patrick Moore?
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah. Now, I remember seeing him at the Olympia a couple years ago. And, you know, in the beginning, they all come out at the show and they do their posing. They do like a kind of like the mandatory poses. They get like a minute on stage or something.
Yeah.
And when he came out, I didn't know it was his first Olympia. Mm-hmm. And I remember the audience really gave him a good reception. And they were like, because he was really ripped. He had great abs. He had a lot of detail in his back. And everybody, like, he got one of the best receptions of anybody in the show.
Right. But he didn't.
But then when they went to compare to everybody else, he was just not big enough. Right. But I thought if you're looking at a physique, he had one of the best physiques.
Yeah.
But he knows the challenge for him is he's got to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Otherwise, he can't compete with these guys.
Yeah, I don't know that guy personally, but I not long ago I read where he's trying to put on a lot of size now. Exactly.
Yeah.
You said he feels it's the only way he can compete, which is sad.
It is sad.
He's going to wind up ruining the beauty of his physique. It's going
right.
to He's going to look bloated like the rest of the guys.
So the days of like Samir and Frank Zane, and they're gone. You know, those guys can never compete in the Open anymore.
No, the only thing we can have that's coming closest to in comparison would be the classic bodybuilding.
Yeah.
You know, those guys are limited, I guess, in how big they can get. So, you know, they come closest to the, let's say, the bodybuilders of the 70s and 60s and all that. But the pro division, forget it. It's never going to go back to.
No. And Patrick Moore, I think, was thinking about doing the classic, but he would have to lose way too much weight. He'd have to lose like over 30 pounds.
Yeah. He's kind of in a limbo area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Too big for the classic, too small for the pro. Guys, I agree with you. I was impressed too. In fact, I think I did a review of that. I did a video for I can't remember, but I did a video and I singled him out.
Yeah,
because he didn't do that well. I said this guy is tremendous. I said this guy is going to be a top pro. I said he's got all the tools, but you know
nothing.
No. Yeah,
they have to put on so much size. It's just just the way of the world now. That's just the way of the bodybuilding world. You know.
And you do pay a price. These guys think they're not going to pay a price.
I know.
Using massive amounts of drugs. They're in dreamland. I don't care what their coaches say.
Yeah.
They're going to be messed up, you know? But what can I say? Everybody has to choose their own.
I think what happened with that guy you're talking about, his coach didn't want him to do the Arnold because he said he needed a break and he wants to do it because he wants to win the money.
Ah, okay.
But he's been competing for like a year and a half straight. I think he's done like six shows and his coach said, you need to take a break. And he doesn't want to take a break.
Yeah. Well, you want to know something? The coach was giving him good advice.
Yeah.
That guy is only what, about 27 years old or something?
26, I think. Yeah.
And he's a young guy. And he probably, you know, when you're in your 20s, if you think back, everybody has this.
Think you're invincible, right?
Nothing's going to ever hurt me.
No.
I'm strong, young, you know, but it doesn't work like that, unfortunately. I mean,
they think 50 is like ancient. You know, being 50 is like really, really, really old.
I remember when I was in my 20s, I look at a guy like 50, like, whoa, this guy's a really old guy.
Right.
I mean, but
they're going to be surprised how fast it goes.
Yeah. I mean, so the coach, he should have listened to that coach. He was giving him good advice. So,
yeah.
Again, remember, we always have to think about a guy like Dallas McCarver, you know,
he's
almost the same age. The guy was doing great. There's another guy I mentioned in a video. I when I saw him pose, I mean, I saw those gigantic calves he had and everything.
Yeah.
I made a flat statement. I said, this guy is a future Mr. Olympia. He's got everything. I was very impressed with the guy. Less than a year later, first he passes out on stage in a contest. Right after that, he dies.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, he was a young guy too. Also probably thought he had the immortality that he could take all this crap and live forever.
Yeah.
You can't, like they say, the old cliche, you can't fool Mother Nature.
No.
It's going to catch up with you.
Yeah.
So, again, I really don't want anyone to get sick. I'm not hoping this.
No, none of us are. No.
But it's like I say to you, John, I almost dread going on Facebook because almost every week there's somebody dying who I knew, you know, even if whether it's Marvin Eder, who I didn't know directly, but I'd seen or knew about. He was an older man. That's different. I mean, but even the younger guys, you know, you still hear stories. I mean, even some of the female, there was a female bodybuilder died at 27 years old.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, come on, what's going on here?
I know.
You know, that's not normal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so.
Well, I mean, Marvin making it to 90, that's incredible. That's amazing. Yeah,
he made it to 90. And, I don't see that happening with the guys today.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't care. I don't know. You know, I mean, that old story about how they asked the Olympic athletes if you could win an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah.
They said, it's okay. We'll die the next day. I mean, what do you do with that type of thinking? You know, I mean, you can't really, all you can do is shrug. I mean,
I know.
That's what they want. Fine. You know,
I mean, they're going to pay the price.
I mean, to me, bodybuilding is great. You're winning titles, but, you know, this should be a life after bodybuilding.
Yeah.
You want to live healthy. And, you know, if you have
and it should contribute to your life.
Yeah, it should contribute to
the lifestyle. Should contribute to it.
Right, you should have kids and stuff. I mean, a lot of people. I see stuff on the web about bodybuilding is unhealthy. I mean, I did a video. Somebody wrote underneath one of my videos, bodybuilding is a very unhealthy activity. I don't agree with that.
No, I don't either.
That's BS. I mean, I'm going by medical science, and the medical science says that weight training is one of the best things you could do.
Yeah.
Because as you get older, if you don't do resistant exercise, inevitably you're going to lose a lot of lean mass, and a loss of muscle is now known to be directly related to increased mortality.
Right.
So done properly, if you follow a good nutritional program, you don't need a lot of garbage, and you do weight training, moderate weight training. You don't try and lift like giant weights when you're 60 years old. It's one of the best things you could do.
Yeah.
Bodybuilding itself is not inherently dangerous or unhealthy. It's the side things that they do, the drug
use,
overtraining, lifting too heavy. That's the kind of stuff that's dangerous.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, Jerry. I want to ask your opinion on that too, because I just posted a video of me doing, I worked out last night doing, I still do those T-bar rows, and I had five plates on there, which is kind of heavy, but I was doing it like 8 times in control. I wasn't jerking it up or anything, you know, and I post it. And every time I do that, it's like, you're going too heavy. You're going to hurt yourself. You're going to hurt your back. You're going to destroy. One guy said, you're going to grind your joints down to powder.
If you're using good form, you're not heaving the weight around.
Right.
And, you know, you don't feel like it's excessively straining your muscles. If you don't, for example, after the workout, if you don't have like a pain in your shoulders and this and
lower back,
then it's fine. In other words, your body can still handle the weight. Now, you know, there might come a time in the next couple of years where you might have to reduce the weight because, and it's not quite, it's more related. It's not necessarily the muscles, the connective tissue starts to dry out. Where it limits the amount, this is what happened with me. It limits the amount of weight you could use, but you'll know it. I mean, you'll feel it. But as long as you're doing it in good form and not having any excessive pain and you're recovering between workouts, it's okay. It's fine. It's not going to hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah. I go pretty heavy, you know, with legs and back. I'm trying to control the weight more. I control it even on the way up and the way down.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember when I was in my 40s. I was training with a younger guy who was about 10 years younger than me. And we were both natural bodybuilders. And when I was in those natural bodybuilding shows, the way I got big in the off season was I would train really heavy, as heavy as I could go for 6 to 8 reps. And I remember we were deadlifting 500 pounds and we were doing presses behind the neck with like 225. And I ended up there was like a couple of years there. It was right around the time I turned 40. I was getting hurt all the time. Like every week I was straining my back, you know, deadlifting heavy or bent over rows or heavy squats. And I knew what it was from. It was from going way too heavy. And finally I said, okay, enough. I'm getting hurt all the time. Right. This is not fun anymore. I don't want to be in pain all the time. So I cut back a little bit. I didn't go as heavy. I was still going heavy, but not as heavy. Right. But like you said, you know, you're going to know when the time is to reduce the weight, you know?
Well, there's one thing there's a way around that. If you really want to train really super heavy, you could do what they call a periodization system, where you keep the heavy weights to about 3 months at a time.
I do that now. Yeah, I do.
Train as heavy as you want. Don't worry about it. Then the next three or four months, you use, let's say, you lighten the weight a little bit. You don't use light weight. You use moderate weight. Well, let's say 8 to 12 reps per set. Good form. And then if you want, let's say you want to get in top shape or you want to plan to go on a diet where lifting weights is harder to do, that would be your final, cycle, where you now just use almost like moderate to light weights.
Yeah.
Let's say 8 to 15 reps per set, even up to 20. And, you know, this training in that manner, the whole idea of the periodization system, it was developed to take the strain off the joints from lifting heavy weights. So that was the whole reason it was developed.
Because
they found for years that if you train heavy all year round, there's an increased danger of injuries all year. Like I said, this is what happened to Dorian Yates and Mike Mentzer.
Yeah.
You know, so if you do it that way, you could lift heavy weights.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of size. It's true. And now 3 months, and then the moderate. Well, you're not going to lose size. You might gain more size.
Right.
You know that'll maintain the muscle size. And then when you slip into lighter, now you could go for higher reps. You know, more muscle definition, and if you still want to, you know, keep even more, so you might even try doing that thing I said where you do like 20 to 30 reps to failure,
yeah,
you know, that will be surprising. Will actually may even push the size up even a little. It's not a bad system if for somebody who wants to train heavy, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I do that now, dude. I do cycle. I go like 7 week cycles, and yeah, one's heavier than a moderate, and then yeah, and yeah, then like you could even go like train faster too when you get to the lighter weights, you know.
That's another thing. Yeah, you could
take less rest time and then the weights feel heavier.
Right. See, because with the heavy weights, what the scientific studies show, if you want to increase strength, you got to rest a minimal of 2 minutes. And for the really heavy stuff like rows and squats, in 3 to up to 4 minutes between sets. And the reason is when you lift heavy like that, you're literally you know, burning out your energy stores in the muscle that causes the muscle to contract. I'm talking about ATP.
ATP, yeah.
Creatine phosphate. And it takes, after a heavy set, it takes at least 3 to 4 minutes to completely put them back. You know, the body will recycle, but it takes time. See, now that's that. If you do that, you'll have maximum strength for the next set. Now you can see it's not a great concern when you're lifting lighter, because your size thing is not, it's not your major goal. So you could cut down the rest.
Yeah. But
the way I train, I'll be honest with you, I take too little rest because I always get to the gym late. It closes. I got to run like a madman. I do like one big set.
Yeah.
I literally rest no more than 20 seconds between each set. And I got to tell you, it destroys my strength. I don't make any strength gains because of that. You know, right. And I know why. You know what I mean? You can't make strength gain, but I have no choice. If I don't train like that, I don't finish the workout.
But it's good. It's good cardiovascular, though.
But I'll tell you a funny thing. Sometimes I try to not to talk during the workout, but sometimes somebody come to me, I'll talk a little bit, and I'll wind up resting, let's say, up to 3 minutes. I take the weight, and now suddenly I'm super strong on the second day.
Right.
Allow my muscle to recover.
Right.
You can actually see the difference, you know?
Yeah. All right, Gerald, let's go into 1991 and do our review of this year from 30 years ago.
Right.
So the first show I want to talk about was the second annual Ironman Invitational. And the first one was won by Sean Ray in 1990.
Right.
And that was a really good show. I was actually there in California that year and saw that, but I didn't see 91. So 91, J.J. Marsh was the winner. And J.J. was a great bodybuilder, great physique.
Yes.
And he had taken fifth the year before when Sean Ray won it. So right. He came back and he won. And Rennell Janvier, remember Rennell Janvier? He was in second.
I knew him well. He was the Rennell, as a matter of fact, when I covered the world championship, I think it was in Australia that year, mm-hmm. I think 89, if I remember correctly. I might have the year wrong. It was held in what do they call that? The Gold Coast. I can't remember the name. Anyway, it was held in Australia. He was on the American team, you know, and he trained at Gold's.
Yeah.
So I really knew him. He was a quiet guy, but always in great shape. And the thing that stands out about Rennell, he's the very first bodybuilder I've ever seen who had ripped glutes.
Yeah.
Shredded.
Really ripped glutes.
You have to understand, John, no male bodybuilder had the shredding. Rich Gasparri followed him, you know, it was, but he was the first. He was showing it in the mid 80s. So when he would pose at a contest, when he would, you know, he had a nice physique cut, don't get me wrong, great abs.
Yeah.
And he looked good. But when he turned to the back, you could hear the audience go, oh, you know, they like,
yeah,
see those ripped up glutes. Nobody had ever seen that.
Yeah.
And people would freak out because they'd never seen that before.
Right.
I mean, today you see women with ripped glutes, which is amazing. That to me is biologically amazing because women's, the way the fat is stored in the glutes is different than it's really hard. Any woman will attest it's very hard for women to lose fat in the glutes and the hips and the upper thighs. And for a woman to have ripped glutes is just, honestly, I hate to say this. I don't think it's naturally possible.
No, I don't either.
I'll leave it at that. In other words, I don't think it's naturally possible for women to get ripped glutes. They got to be two of them, but let's leave it at that, you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead. So go ahead and continue.
So Andreas Munzer was in third place.
Oh, yeah, Andreas.
Jerry Pastel was fourth, and Vince Taylor was fifth.
Wow, Vince Taylor was fifth.
Yeah.
Did I tell you the story about when I first met Vince Taylor? I don't know if I told you. It was actually in Germany.
Germany, okay, with John Brown.
Yeah, he was. John Brown had apparently got him into bodybuilding or something, but he wasn't competing. he was at the contest, and you know, I just started talking to him, and we were talking about John Brown, who we both knew, and he said to and I was with a guy named Julian Schmidt, who was also a writer for Weider at Flex.
Oh yeah, I remember him. Yeah, I
remember him. He used to wear cowboy hats and stuff.
Yeah.
And so you know, he happened to have pictures with him. You know, the, Vince had pictures 8x10s, and I looked at him and I was shocked how good he. I said, "My God!" You know, I saw his, he had huge calves.
Yeah.
He says, "Why aren't you competing?" I said, "You have a pro physique." And I remember him saying, I'll never forget, he said to me and Jill, he says, you know what? I don't think I'm good enough to be a pro. I can't stand on stage with these guys. That's what he said. And,
yeah.
And as history unfolds, you see, did he hold the record for competing in the
most? Yeah, he won more pro shows at one time than anyone else. Yeah.
He wound up being a top pro, but I'll never forget those words. He had no confidence in himself at all at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the guy was tremendous, you know.
Yeah.
He's still in great shape, and he's in his mid-50s.
Oh, I know. He's unbelievable. 60s. Yeah,
he's in his 60s.
Yeah.
Still in great shape, you know. But who was the other guys that you mentioned? There was
Andreas Munzer.
Oh, yeah, Munzer.
Third place.
Yeah, Munzer. Yeah, Mr. Ripped, yeah.
And let me see who else. Thierry Pestel, great bodybuilder. He was in fourth.
I thought Thierry Pestel, honestly, I mean, They run this tape at Gold's Gym on this big screen, you know, that's in a loop. It runs over. It's one of the Mr. Olympias that Thierry Pestel competed in. And every time I look at it, I'm thinking, this guy was so underrated, man.
Oh, totally underrated. Yeah, I agree. Short.
He was, what, 5'5", 5'6"? He wasn't tall.
Probably 5'5", yeah.
But look at this guy. Jeez, he had like a almost like an his mentor was Serge Gnabry.
Right, right.
And the thing is that he had like everything Serge Gnabry had, but even better arms.
Oh, way bigger. His arms were gigantic.
I mean, when he did the arm shot, it was startling.
I
mean,
I know.
Even looking at this video, go do a Google search for photos of Thierry Pestel. Look at his arms and see if I'm exaggerating. His arms, and he had these thick abs, and he had that thing I always talk about, how it amazed me. Because usually when you have a guy with thick abs, they have a wider waist.
Right.
Just like his mentor, Serge Gnabry, they both had thick abs and a small waist.
Right, right.
Steve Reeves, the great Steve Reeves, used to make a statement. They asked him if he did abdominal work. He said no, because he felt that when he built his abdominals, Steve Reeves is all into having a very tiny waist.
Right.
So he felt that doing any abdominal work would widen his waist, so he didn't do it.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, these guys disproved him wrong. Of course, a lot of it's genetic, but they had great abs and a tiny, tiny waist.
Well, Thierry's abs were so deep. You'll put your fingers up. Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, they couldn't have been better. I mean, plus he had a good back. He had good legs. I mean,
his legs were huge, too.
I don't understand why. Maybe because of the height.
I don't either.
To me, this guy should have been Mr. Olympia.
Yeah. They always placed him low all the time.
Yeah.
Especially at the Mr. Olympia, he wouldn't even make top 10.
Did I tell you the funny story about when Serge Gnabry got mad at me? I had to do it with Thierry Pestel.
No.
Okay. I was writing for Weider, and I was scheduled to meet Thierry Pestel at Gold's Gym to interview him, but Terry only spoke French, so the interpreter was going to be none other than Serge Gnabry himself. Okay, so I get to the gym. But unfortunately, I was something like 7 minutes late, right? And Serge Gnabry was in the on the side of the gym, the area, you know, where, you know, it's like a couple of tables and chairs. Serge Gnabry, a lot of people don't know this, he had a hair-triggered temper. He had a very, very bad temper. Now, I knew Serge Gnabry previously, so Serge Gnabry immediately starts yelling at me. Why are you late? Listen, blah, 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 blah. He goes, and I'm not saying, I'm just looking at him. He goes on for about 7 minutes yelling at me how unprofessional I am and this and that. And so I listen to him. I don't say anything. I look at him. I said, I apologize, Serge. You're right. I should have been on time. By the way, where's Terry? He says he's not here yet. Terry showed up a half hour late. I didn't make an issue of it, though. I always remember that story, you know. Serge Gnabry, he calmed down and he was friendly after that. He, you know, he never held a grudge, or he was, you know, the whole thing was forgotten 5 minutes later, you know. But, you know, I don't remember what the interview was about. It was so long ago.
Yeah.
I got his arm training. I don't remember, but he was a nice guy, Terry. He was a very nice guy. You know, He's another guy that, as far as I know, he's still in good shape too.
Is he? Okay.
Yeah. He's still in good shape.
It's 30 years ago that he was competing, so that was a long time ago.
It's a shame that he just was overlooked so badly.
Yeah, it really was.
Terrible, you know?
Now, the Arnold Classic, I think, took place a week or 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is Vince Taylor, I remember him in that Iron Man. It seemed like he was way off. He was holding water, and I remember he even had, like, little gyno.
Oh, yeah.
At the Iron Man. So right. 2 weeks later, he really tightened up a lot. And he went from fifth place at the Iron Man to third place at the Arnold Classic, which is a tougher show.
Right.
But Sean Ray, who was suspended the year before, because he won it in 1990, and then they caught him. They failed the drug test. He had to give back the money. I think it was $60,000 and the trophy. And so he came back and got redemption 1 year later, and he won, I think, pretty easily.
Yeah.
Sean won that contest very easily because Vince was off. So Vince was in third, and Rennell Janvier was in second again.
Yeah.
J.J. Marsh, who just won the Ironman, dropped down to fourth.
Wow.
And Thierry Pestel was fifth again.
Right. In that 90, if I remember correctly, when they took away the title, it was after the contest.
It was after the contest, yeah, because they did the drug testing.
Mike Ashley, who was second. Mike Ashley was at the 1990 Arnold winner.
Right.
I remember Sean Ray, for some reason, didn't want to return the trophy. I don't remember the reasoning why, but I remember there was a little controversy about that. But he eventually returned it. Of course, he was back in good grace. And as you say, he won it that year in 91.
Yeah.
He came back and redeemed himself, so to speak, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so really, Sean Ray could have been a two-time winner if they wouldn't have done the testing. But they
That's
did,
right. So. Yeah. Yeah.
And what was interesting was Steve Brisbois, who we talked about before, the little guy from Canada, he was in sixth, so he did really well.
Yeah.
And Rich Gaspari, who won the first Arnold Classic 2 years ago in 1989, was dropped down to seventh.
Wow.
So that was probably the beginning of the end for Rich Gaspari because he had taken fifth at the Olympia the year before.
Right.
And he had taken fourth the year before that.
Right.
And so now he was down to seventh. And then when he went in the Olympia that year in 1991, he was 10th. So I think that was pretty much the end of his career.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
And Robbie was eighth, so Robbie was probably off.
Yeah, right.
And Mohamed Benaziza was really off. He took 11th.
Wow. Well, that's unusual for Mohamed Benaziza.
Yeah.
Another guy who was fantastic. Jeez.
And Bob Parris was 16th.
16th?
Yeah.
That's do not place, isn't it? I mean, really?
Yeah. Ron Love was 14th.
Ron Love, yeah.
Guys were a couple of these guys are really out of shape, but
yeah,
that was only the third annual Arnold Classic because they only had that was the only third one they started in 1989. So,
right, yeah, I'm not sure what happened to those guys, why they entered in kind of they probably were holding water or something like that.
Yeah, yeah,
some of these guys, I mean, unless they were like in ripped shape, they didn't look good. I mean, they didn't, we could see that they weren't going to do well.
So right.
Had to, you know, guys like Ron Love and the other guys, I mean, they had to be ripped or they just wouldn't place well.
Yeah.
They had to be in really good shape, you know, maximum shape.
Yeah. Another show I wanted to mention was this was in the spring. This was after the Arnold Classic. It was the Niagara Falls Pro Invitational.
Yeah.
And they used to hold that show every year back then. And Albert Beckles won. I think that was probably the last show Albert Beckles won.
Is that right? 91? Yeah. I think he was 94 at that show.
How old was he really? Let's see. Because he was born, his real birthday was 38, right? 1938.
He's 10 years younger than what he claims, whatever he claims.
Yeah.
I think he claims 91 now, so he's 81.
So I think he was 53 for sure, like actual 53.
But you know what, though?
That's amazing.
I mean, when you think about it, that's tremendously impressive.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's got to be the record, right? I mean, nobody else was that age.
I mean, I don't know why he exaggerates his age, but the point is to be if he's beating bodybuilders, half his age. He's 53.
53, yeah.
53, most guys are done. I mean, forget about a pro show. I mean, to do that is a tremendous accomplishment. You got to give the guy credit, you know?
I'm pretty sure that was his last win. But that's amazing.
Yeah. It is amazing.
Sonny Schmidt was second and Tom Terwilliger was third.
Yeah. Tom Terwilliger. Yeah. Nice guy, Tom. Yeah.
Tom always talks about that contest every time I have him on because Tom was a great poser.
Yeah, he was.
And he said Albert beat him in the posing round.
And he can't figure that out?
He didn't think Albert should have beat him in the posing round. Because remember how Albert used to do that dance?
Yeah,
he
used
to hit a pose and then he would dance. He would like do the shuffle, the Albert Beckel shuffle.
Yeah.
So
well, the same thing happened if you remember at the 90 Olympia when Lee Haney beat Lee Labrada in the posing round.
Yeah, right.
Lee Labrada, who almost anyone will agree with, was one of the greatest poses in bodybuilding history.
Right.
Watching him was like a ballet. I mean, the guy was unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, and no offense to Lee, but Lee just didn't flow in his posing like Lee Labrada did.
Not like Lee Labrada, no.
And you might remember the story I told you when I asked the judges how they could possibly have Lee Haney beating Labrada in posing. They said, well, no, posing doesn't mean the routine. It means how well you present yourself. Which to this day I don't understand that
at all. No, that's fudging with the interpretation, yeah. Right?
That I call that a politician's answer, which is
not
an answer, you know.
Right.
You know. So.
Well, let's talk about the other big show that spring. That was the Night of the Champions, and this was Dorian Yates' first IFBB Pro victory.
Right.
So Dorian had taken second the year before to Mohamed Benaziza.
Yeah.
And now he came back and he really improved a lot. You know, I remember then when Dorian was just starting his IFBB pro career, he was making significant improvements every year. It was unbelievable.
That's true.
And back then, Jerry, Dorian really had a real symmetrical physique. He was known as a mass monster, like we were talking about, but he had a very small waist.
Right.
When that front lat spread, even the front double bicep, incredible, great aesthetics, great shape.
Right.
Really ripped and in great condition. He had an amazing physique that year.
I think the change in Dorian occurred somewhere around the mid-90s.
Yeah.
I think it's when he started using...
93. That's when he got really big.
That's when he started using the insulin GH steroid combo.
Yeah.
And it made him very big, but it produced that look we were talking about earlier. That kind of like monstrous look. And towards the end, he even started to get a bloated stomach, which was really... Neutral, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, because he didn't, as you point out, he didn't have that at all in 91. He was very hard shape, ripped, you know.
He didn't have the torn bicep at that time, so he was very, very symmetrical and, you know, really great physique.
At that contest, I believe I asked him, let me think, 91. Yeah, I think it was 91. I interviewed him and I said, what's your goal, Dorian? He told me he wanted to be the Olympia winner of the 90s, meaning he wanted to win the Olympia through the 90s and then retire. Yeah. And, you know, it turns out he was right. That's exactly what he did. You know, his prediction came true. He said he was going to win every year until for maybe 6 years in a row and then quit.
Yeah.
He told me that.
I think this was the contest that really established him, that where everybody was talking about him, you know, because I interviewed Vince Taylor. And Vince said when they got to the Olympia that year, everybody was talking about Dorian. They thought Dorian was going to upset Lee Haney.
Oh, you mean in 90?
In 91, yeah.
Yeah. And, 91.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, as a matter of fact, I remember, let me think. Yeah, it was 91. That's when I was walking around. I was walking around the lobby, and one of the IFBB officials came up to me. And he said, Jerry, there's going to be, you know, because remember, Lee Haney had won it every year, you know, and for several years. This is what, his eighth Mr. Olympia, right?
Yeah, his eighth one, yeah.
And this guy says to me, there's going to be a new Mr. Olympia crowned tonight. This was after the prejudging.
Yeah.
I said to him, Senevich, are you saying that Lee lost? He said, I'm not saying anything. He said, I'm just telling you, don't be surprised if there's a new Mr. Olympia crowned tonight.
Yeah.
And so I said, it has to be Dorian Yates.
Yeah, I think Dorian beat Lee in the mandatory poses in the muscle memory.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I was sitting, this was in Orlando, Florida, if I remember correctly, this contest. Right. And I remember sitting in the press section right next to the late, you remember Don Ross, you know, writer. And we were watching the comparisons. And, you know, from the front, Dorian stood like, he was right there with Lee. I mean, you know, Lee had certain things on him. Lee had thicker pecs.
Yeah.
I felt that, maybe the arms were about the same, but, you know, Dorian was maybe a little bit harder in the midsection. There's a little harder look overall. And, you know, I said to Don, I said, gee, this is a tough one to pick, Don. I said, you know, Lee's great. He's in fantastic shape. But look at this guy, Dorian. I mean, he's peaked to the gills. I mean, he can't be any better than he is.
Yeah.
But that says, wait, let's see what happens when they turn to the back. So they did the back, and that's when Don and I both looked at each other. So I says, we knew. That's when we knew that Haney won. Mm. But it's not that Dorian didn't have a great back, but Lee's back was in fantastic shape that year. It was wide, thick. And you could just see, if you look at the photos, Lee edged him out on the back. I believe that Lee won the contest on the basis of having a better back than Dorian that year. In subsequent years, Dorian's back improved.
Yeah, it was much better.
The contest was held like 3 years later. Let's say, then Dorian would have won.
Yeah. Because
Dorian's back had improved so much in that 2 or 3 year period that he had the thickness and everything increased.
Yeah.
He would have beaten Lee. He would have beaten Lee. Yeah. But that year, Lee beat him on the back, I believe.
And Lee had a smaller waist, too. So from the front.
Yeah, that's another thing. He definitely had a smaller waist.
Yeah.
Although, you know, there's no question who had the better calves. That was definitely Dorian.
Yeah.
He had those just freaky calves, you know.
And great hamstrings, too. I remember that was the thing that with Dorian, when he turned to the back, he not only had the back muscles.
Yeah.
But he also had his glutes were really hard. He had incredible hamstrings, and he had those huge calves. So it was the whole picture, you know.
Yeah, I know. When he turned to the back, it was like all over for everybody.
All over, yeah, for everybody.
And you know, in subsequent years, when Dorian competed, as long as I covered the Olympia, you know, I went to him most of those years. When you get to the contest, it was always the discussion was who would play second.
Yeah.
it was like a foregone conclusion that you
had to
win. Everyone was trying to figure out who would get second, third, and fourth. Nobody even considered that anyone would beat Yates. He was that dominant.
I know. Yeah.
Because this happened later on with Ronnie Coleman.
With Ronnie Coleman, too, right? Yeah.
Big deal, you know.
So at that night of the champions, Sonny Schmidt was a really good bodybuilder from Australia. He was in second place.
Yeah.
Sonny died at a pretty young age, but he died of lung cancer, right? Because he used to smoke.
Yeah, he died in 2004, I believe. But unfortunately, he had an unfortunate incident happen in 2000. Unfortunately, he got involved with this big cocaine dealer in Australia, and he got caught transporting cocaine to this dealer, and he did 3 years in prison.
Wow.
Now, Sonny Schmidt was an interesting guy. He had a great physique, as you know, but I consider him, if you said to me, who is the number one toughest interview you ever did in bodybuilding, it would be Sonny Schmidt, mainly because I almost felt there should have been English subtitles. Because honestly, it's not that the guy was a bad guy. He was a nice guy, but I just didn't understand a word he was saying. I said, what is your back routine? That's the way I just couldn't make out what he was saying.
Wow.
And this is one of the only times, I think it was the only time when I interviewed a bodybuilder where I just couldn't write the article because I took notes, but I didn't have enough to write an article. Yeah. I couldn't write it. I mean, it felt bad, but I mean, I just couldn't make out what he was saying. He was good friends with Milos Sarchev, was one of his best friends. If I was using my head, Milos was in the vicinity. I should have called over Milos to translate. I wasn't trying to insult Sonny. I just couldn't make out what he was saying. And Milos could have translated, and I could have written the article, but I didn't. I just didn't work.
Yeah.
So I shook his hand after a half hour. I said, "Thanks a lot, Sonny. We'll do." I knew it wouldn't go. I knew it. You know, but he was a great bodybuilder. But you know.
Yeah, he had really good leg development. I remember.
I remember he did tell me something in that interview that I still do remember. He told me he had he was from Samoa. He had several brothers, and he said his brother. I laugh when I get a picture of them. He said his brothers were all over 400 pounds. He called himself the runt of the family.
Yeah, wow.
That's what he called himself. I'm getting a mental image of these giant because Samoans, you know,
they're huge.
They tend to be big fat guys. A lot of them, you know.
Yeah. So,
He just was a genetic anomaly. He was a smaller guy who wound up being a great bodybuilder.
Yeah.
He went 360 degrees from his brothers.
Those guys have such unbelievable genetics for size and strength.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know,
there's a guy at our gym. He's in the medical industry, and he comes in with his scrubs on all the time. And you could tell just when he walks, he's a big guy, you know, and he's not a bodybuilder. He never competes.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll see him training in a t-shirt. I swear to God, Jerry, he's got at least 22 inch arms, at least.
And he's muscular. He's muscular too.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not ripped, but he's muscular. He's not fat. He's not like a fat Samoan.
Right.
I told my training partner, I said, I want to tape that guy's arms one day. His arms look like they're at least 22, 23 inches. His triceps are so big.
Yeah.
I remember he was benching once by himself. There was no partner or nothing. He had four plates on there. He's doing like nothing.
Wow.
And he doesn't even go that heavy, and he doesn't train hard.
Yeah.
Because he's not competing or anything. He's just naturally huge. If this guy ever competed, he would blow people away.
Reminds me of the story Sergio Oliva once told. I don't know if you ever heard this one. Sergio claimed he was from a family of, I think, 19 or 20 children. You know?
Jeez.
Yeah, he had 20 children in his family. But he used to tell a story of they said his name was Diego. He said he had an older brother in Cuba that made him look like a pipsqueak.
Oh, God.
That made him look tiny.
That's unbelievable.
That he says he had all of my, the small waist, you know, everything. But he was like twice as big as me. And I tried to picture this, and it almost scared me.
Yeah, right.
Think of a guy, Sergio Oliva, a gigantic version of him was scary to me.
Can you imagine if he had the small waist too?
Right. You know, he said he had the small, he said he had everything I had twice big, right? He said he was even smaller. You know? So when I met his son, Sergio Oliva Jr., this was in my mind for years because I never saw a picture of this alleged version. So I said to Sergio Jr., one of the first conversations I had, I said, tell me, I got to ask you something. Your father said that he had a brother in Cuba that was much bigger and more muscular than him. Is that true? So Sergio Jr. said, well, if it's true, he never told me about it. I never heard it.
Yeah.
He said, you never saw any photos of his family? But he says, I never saw anybody that fits that description.
Yeah. Yeah. He had his son kind of late in life. So.
Yeah. So
I remember it was in 84 when he was in the Olympia last time, or one of the last times. Remember, that's when he held him up on stage.
Yeah, held the baby. Yeah. That was Sergio Jr. And didn't he say he was something like a future Mr. Olympia or something like that? Or, you know?
Yeah. He said he's holding in his hands a future myth or something.
The future myth, of course, Sergio, it turns out that Sergio Sr. discouraged Sergio Jr.
Right,
Because Sergio Sr. always felt that he got bad breaks from Weider and all that. He didn't want his son to go through that. He was trying to spare him the pain, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, that's another story.
Did you ever hear, you remember Geir Borgen Paulsen, the guy who was in third place?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact,
Joe Weider.
Yeah, Norway. Joe Weider, in 1990, you remember when they started the WBF, Mitsu Man was handing out money like crazy to the bodybuilders that competed.
Right.
That's the only time Joe gave anyone anything that worked for him, including the bodybuilder. He felt precious. He had to do something. What he did with me is he didn't give me a raise or extra money. What he did is he gave me and my girlfriend had a business at the time called Fox Nutrition, a little health food store. He gave me a free ad in Muscle and Fitness and Flex magazines that ran for about a year. Mm-hmm. They used to send me bills where the one for Muscle and Fitness. This is when Muscle and Fitness was the biggest bodybuilding magazine in the world. You know, the early
right.
They'd send me a bill for $30,000, and then it said amount due 00. In other words, he was trying to say, here, I'm giving you a $24,000 a month raise, you know, because I'm giving you a free ad. And the one for Flex was something like $18,000 a month. This went on for about a year or two, you know. But the guy in the photo, it was a guy holding up some Weider protein cans. That was Geir Paulsen.
Oh, okay.
He was a bodybuilder. He probably never knew that he was used to that, you know, but he was the guy, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, I saw him once at Gold's Gym, and I was going to say something, but I decided not to. He might get pissed off or something like that. He might ask me for money. Wait a minute, what do you mean?
Right.
I decided not to say anything, you know. But he was a big guy.
Yeah, it looked like he had good potential, but he never really did anything.
No, nothing. I don't know why.
That was the highest placing you ever had, was that third place at the Night of the Champions.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't clearly remember any weak points he had. I couldn't tell you why.
Yeah. And he was tall too. He had good structure.
Yeah. Well, he kind of is like that other guy from the Scandinavian. Remember, who was the guy with the big forearms we talked about?
Gunnar Raspal.
Yeah. He's another guy.
Yeah.
That you know, just nothing really, didn't do anything at all. So, and yet, you know, he had some tremendous body. Him and Brisbane, we mentioned earlier, probably had the best natural forearms I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to see these guys' forearms. Well, Chuck Sipes was up there too, but I never saw him in person.
These two,
I saw their forearms up close, and they were like legs.
Yeah.
They were gigantic.
Yeah,
unbelievable. I asked both men the same question. I said, how did you get those forearms? I thought they'd say, well, we did 20 sets of wrist curls. Nothing.
Genetic.
They didn't do a thing. They didn't work.
Right.
Mike Gibson told me the same thing when I asked him, how'd you get those forearms? I don't do any forearm work. And here I am with my skinny forearms trying to.
Right. Right.
Well, what are you going to do?
Yeah, Thierry Pestel was fourth in that show, so he did good again in another show. And then Ron Love was fifth.
Yeah.
And then Twilliger was sixth. Duckles was seventh. So Beckles had dropped. And then Mike Ashley was eighth, which is interesting because only a couple of years earlier, Mike Ashley was a close second in the Night of the Champions. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Mike had really dropped down by the 1990s because it was just the competition was getting too tough, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mike had a great build, you know, very symmetrical, but he wasn't a big guy, you know.
No, he was kind of narrow, and he didn't weigh that much either.
No, he didn't. He was like 180, something like 185, something, but maybe 190. And, you know, you put him in a lineup with the bigger guys, he's going to be overshadowed. And that probably accounts for his low placing of the contest.
Yeah.
It wasn't that he wasn't in shape, because I'll tell you one thing about Mike Ashley. He was always in shape. He was a fanatic.
Oh, yeah. Always.
I remember in Europe, he used to bring his own food in Tupperware. He wouldn't eat in restaurants. He was so pragmatic, and he just weighed everything he ate. This guy would never
ridiculous.
You'd never enter a contest. I said to him, do you still do that? He says, yeah.
Yeah.
You're still that meticulous about it? He says, absolutely.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Jerry Branum for again joining us for our year-end review. And next week, of course, we will have part two of our interview with Jerry, where we'll talk about the rest of the competitions from 1991. All right. So as promised, I want to read an excerpt from the book. It's called Legends of the Iron Game, and it was written by Bill Pearl himself, the legendary Bill Pearl. And it is a 3-volume set, and this comes from volume 2, and it is about the life of Marvin Etter. It is chapter 35 in this volume 2 book. And it says, Marvin Etter, born October 22nd, 1931 in Brooklyn, New York. And Marvin just passed away a couple days ago. It says, Marvin Etter is recognized as one of the world's greatest natural strength athletes. He attained a world-class physique. However, it was his freakish power at a body weight of around 200 pounds that fueled his lasting legend as he surpassed the efforts of all but a few super heavyweights from his era. Etter appeared like a comet in the late 1940s, handling poundages and exercises and training with a fanaticism that few of today's bodybuilders care to approach. At a height of 5'8" and weighing under 200 pounds, Etter became the third person to officially bench press 500 pounds. It was not until the steroid era began that anyone of Etter's body weight bench pressed that amount. In 1953, at a weight of 198 pounds, Marvin unofficially clean and pressed 355 pounds, a weight above the world record. He also accomplished a parallel bar dip of 435 pounds while weighing 198 pounds, a feat which has never been equaled. Inspired by John Grimmick, Etter began strength training at age 15 as a member of the East Side Barbell Club in Brooklyn. In 1948, he placed second at the IFBB Junior Mr. America, and he won his division at the IFBB Junior North American Weightlifting Championships. In 1950, Marvin captured the IFBB Mr. Eastern America title, and in 1951 placed a respectable third at the AAU Mr. America contest. At a body weight of 203 pounds, his measurements were 34-inch waist, 49-inch chest, 19-inch neck, 19-inch biceps, 26-inch thighs, and 17-inch calves.
In 1952, Etter was declared a professional athlete by the AAU over a disputed $15 guest appearance. Marvin was so devastated by the AAU ruling that he quit competitive heavy lifting. This tragedy cost the United States one of the best 198-pound lifters and bodybuilding one of its most inspirational up-and-coming superstars. Bodybuilder strongman Reg Park said of Etter, "We had a lot in common. We were more strength athletes than bodybuilders. We had great workouts at Abe Goldberg's gym in New York. We used 120-pound dumbbells for seated presses, and we did barbell rows with 400 pounds. Etter remarked that Reg Park was one of the few able to keep up with him during a workout. We were squatting 475 pounds for sets of eight reps and 520 pounds for triples. Pat Casey, the greatest bench presser of the 1960s, declared in the December 1993 issue of Iron Master magazine, "In my opinion, pound for pound, Marvin Etter is the strongest man to walk the face of the earth." In that same issue, writer and historian Charles A. Smith argued, "As to who's the strongest of all strongmen, three spring to mind: Herman Gornier, Doug Hepburn, and Marvin Etter. If it came to my choice, I'd plump for Etter. At his body weight, I doubt anyone has been stronger. He was phenomenal. In the 1950s, he was using high-intensity training when several of the modern crop who were claiming to have invented it weren't lifting anywhere near heavier than a baby's rattle." Married in 1957, Marvin evolved into a master plumber and until recently continued to manage his business. In the late 2009, he still trains regularly using exercises comfortable for him, such as wide grip chins, parallel bar dips, jump squats, handstand push-ups, and leg raises hanging from a chinning bar. He commented to veteran bodybuilder and journalist David Robson concerning his present trends in bodybuilding. "Health was never divorced from my training. I've never, under any circumstances, considered the use of artificial drugs to stimulate my muscle growth. What's going on now is a nightmare, an obscenity. In a way, I hope the whole thing disappears, but it's getting worse with time. I'll not lend my presence to any show, even if they were to honor me. That's in the past. I don't care what present bodybuilders' goals are. If you want to get muscular and stronger, work out hard and look after yourself like I did. Still, you can't beat genetics. Can anyone be an Einstein? No, they can't." Marvin was honored by the Association of Old-Time Barbell and Strongmen in 1989, and he was inducted into the Oscar Heidenstam Foundation Hall of Fame in 2001. Wow, what a great career. 90 years old. That just shows what bodybuilding is capable of if you do it right. And I think Marvin proved that. And man, I'm another guy. I wish I could have had a chance to interview him. To be honest with you, I didn't even know Marvin was still alive, and I didn't know he was still around. So what a great life, 90 years old. So we salute the memory of Marvin Etter, and we also offer our condolences to all the friends and family of Tom Prince, who died at the age of 52. Terrible. All right, folks. So that's all we got for this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. And thank you to all our Patreon donors who generously donate to our show every month. And I couldn't do the show without you guys. So thank you very much. And hopefully we will have more for our Patreon donors this year. I will have some time to donate more to you guys for helping us out so much. Next week, as I said, we'll be back with part two of our interview with Jerry Branham, where we continue our discussion on 1991. Until then, guys, stay safe out there. Don't get the COVID. And continue training hard. And we'll see you guys next week. Take care.